We're at the Grand Lubacan Resort, which is just outside Tahoe City in California. There is snow outside. This is one of the Keystone Symposia on Molecular and Cellular Biology, and this one's on new insights into health span and diseases of aging from molecular to functional senescence. And we are with Andrzej, or Andy Bartke, who we last saw in Santa Barbara. Andy gave the keynote lecture in the introductory evening, and we're following up on a few remarks there. Before we get into this, your discussion about growth hormone and so on, there was a comment made in the introduction of you, which mentioned that although you once had the Methuselah Mouse Prize from the Methuselah Foundation, that you are now in competition for another mouse prize with David Sinclair from Harvard and Sertris and so on. This is true, this is not true. It appears to be true on the website at the Methuselah Foundation.
Well, Michał Mastenak, my colleague in the lab, is officially in competition, and he described the kind of animal that he works with and provided information to the Methuselah Prize people. And so he is, I think, considered formally a contestant. I think my connection is that we are working on longevity, but that's about it.
So they're using your name in vain, possibly? I don't know.
You know, I think they are doing very good things, trying to get good publicity for aging research, and I am all for it. And if they feel that my participation does some good, I'm happy.
When we last talked, you mentioned what the name of your keynote was going to be. I think you had it at the time, and it was Growth Hormone Elixir of Youth or Dangerous Snake Oil. And we did talk a little bit about that, but there was some new work that you were talking about last night. And the discussion was really about growth hormone, whether it in fact is anti-aging, whether it does in fact work. And obviously there's lots of people out there going to various organizations asking for hormone replacement therapy, growth hormone, and so on. In the time since we've spoken, in the work that you've been doing in your lab and so on, is there anything what's your position now on growth hormone? Is it an elixir of life or a snake oil?
Well, what I was trying to say was that we really need to know more before we either condemn growth hormone or advocate it. And that the data which are available are really not very complete, because the number of studies is limited. Most of the studies were small, relatively short term. Use of growth hormone as an anti-aging agent, if it ever was to materialize, would presumably be very long-term use, something akin to estrogen replacement, postmenopausal treatment, or androgen replacement in aging men showing symptoms of hypogonadism. Also, because of just maybe the way that the story developed, I think that objective analysis of data that are available is somewhat clouded or complicated by the fact that people seem to have very strong opinions and be very strongly either on one or on the other side of the argument. And I'm trying to avoid, this sort of dogmatic position that growth hormone is dangerous and harmful and it should be avoided at all cost, or that it has excellent potential as one of the means of changing various unwelcome symptoms of aging. So far, the evidence for benefits of growth hormone in endocrinologically normal elderly is not very persuasive. There, There are some data that look good. Meta-analysis that was published in Annals of Internal Medicine, I think a couple of years ago, concluded that the risk-benefit ratio was really not favorable, and that there was no justification to recommend as a treatment of endocrinologically normal elderly people. Of course, such treatment also is against the law in the United States. Growth hormone is one of these unusual substances, very few, I don't know if there are any others, in fact, that is forbidden to be off-label used. Growth hormone is to be prescribed for specific defined indications, and being over a certain age is not an indication for prescribing growth hormone. Growth hormone can be prescribed for adult growth hormone deficiency. And that's where things become a little bit fuzzy, because growth hormone declines with age and obviously declines not uniformly in everybody. So in some older people, I think you could make an argument that they are growth hormone deficient, and it gets into sort of gray zone, whether it's part of physiological aging or in fact something that could be considered endocrine failure that calls for replacement. Also, I think what also colors, you know, various things that are said and published about growth hormone is that, as I was illustrating yesterday in my talk with, you know, a couple of ads, lots of the promotion of the use of growth hormone or growth hormone relayment products is blatantly commercial and irresponsible. That it's sort of ads that promise you the moon and the sky, and also try to argue for this scientifically using really very often incorrect arguments, because people cite numerous studies in which people benefited from growth hormone therapy. If you look up at these studies, these are not elderly people, these are people who were in the middle age and they lost growth hormone secretion as a result of disease. And that's a different story. And this is an approved indication for growth hormone treatment. And in these people, growth hormone clearly is a beneficial therapy. And no one really argues that. But what is being argued is, can you take this data set and extrapolate from them to people who have low growth hormone levels simply because they're older? And there is really no good evidence that you can. Because in fact, most people who were involved in performing the studies or in analysis of the data are under the impression that growth hormone doesn't work as well in elderly people as it works in younger people. And also that in this group of people, it has more negative side effects, untoward side effects. So the literature on, really doesn't provide very good justification for using growth hormone. Now, but there are still, issues which have not been resolved. There was really not enough well-designed long-term studies with the reasoned number of individuals to be sure that most of the studies are somewhat limited. And another issue is that I think it would be entirely reasonable to ask the question, isn't there a subset of the elderly population that might benefit from growth hormone therapy? That, in other words, that being over 65 or over 70 is not necessarily an indication, as it isn't an indication for getting testosterone replacement, for example. But looking at both at symptoms, looking at problems that people may have, if there is a combination of low growth hormone levels and symptoms which could be ascribed to low growth hormone levels, then perhaps there may be better rationale or better hope for some positive effects. And the area which really needs investigation is the issue of sarcopenia, loss of muscle mass with age and frailty, where it is argued that growth hormone has potential beneficial effects because it does increase muscle mass. And well, that's well documented.
But interestingly, although it's documented that it will increase muscle mass, it doesn't necessarily increase muscle strength. Though,
that's correct. That's correct. So, in the few studies that tested this, it did not.
So there's a couple of things here. One, clearly there's a continuum here from treating pathology to treating wounded vanity. So, but there's also the point of which you often hear from people, which is, if I sit and wait until they've done all these definitive studies, I'll be dead anyway by then. So let me try this stuff now. I mean, how do you answer people who say that?
Well, you know, there are significant concerns that growth hormone therapy could increase risk for medical conditions which are significant. Mm-hmm. And this is insulin resistance, diabetes, and cancer, you know, very significant conditions. And I'm not trying to say that there's, you know, any immediate danger, but there are certainly very sound reasons to link growth hormone with these problems. So if there is no good evidence for benefits, then you know, trying it anyway may not be a very good idea.
Good,
I would actually argue that it is not a very good idea.
Right. We mentioned earlier, we were talking earlier about some of the solutions that people are discussing, and I mentioned that I picked up this book on the way, Michael Pollan's book, and you know who Michael Pollan is, of course, the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and various other books, and he has a new little book out called Food Rules, which I suppose could be taken two ways, Food Rules or Rules About Food, an eater's manual, and these are very simple solutions and so on. You know, don't eat anything that your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. Avoid food products containing ingredients that no ordinary human would keep in the pantry. Avoid food products that contain high fructose, corn syrup. Mm-hmm. Avoid food products that contain more than 5 ingredients. Some of these are interesting. Avoid food products containing ingredients that the third grader cannot pronounce. Do you think that, in fact, a lot of the problem is that people simply don't understand exactly what they are putting into their bodies, and that if they were following these food rules of his, that things would be better off?
Well, I think that you know, our species in 21st century is experiencing obviously a major problem of balancing food intake and energy expenditure. And I think this is obvious from thinking how we live and what percentage of our life is spent essentially sitting down and looking at the computer screen or operating machinery or operating a car or watching TV. And also, just looking around, what's happening to people's silhouettes, I think, would easily convince you that there is a problem. And now, where does the problem come from? Well, there's lots of research. There are lots of factors which are obviously involved. Some of them are very indirect. Some of them are difficult to understand or to explain, such as transgenerational effects of early development, or maybe effects of nutrition of your parents, or perhaps even grandparents. But, you know, the basic problem is, I think, the balance between the intake and the expenditure. Mm-hmm. That if you have very little physical activity, then it's very easy to eat much more than you need. And the result of this is that you gain weight. And this is, I think, reasonably well documented risk factors for various significant problems. Diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, you know, all the biggies are related to obesity. And there are obviously many people who are grossly overweight by the usual criteria such as BMI and are perfectly healthy and live normal lives and never become diabetic. So, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, point at anybody who is overweight that they're doomed, but statistically the associations are very strong that being overweight is not good for you. Now, there are also issues which I think intersect with this, and this is what we eat. And I think that there are many aspects of our diet which are probably very unhealthy. And I think one of the aspects which many, I'm not a nutritionist, so I'm quoting work of others, mm-hmm. but one aspect that many people pinpoint as very, very unhealthy is that a very large proportion of the calories that we consume is refined sugar. That we ingest large amounts of sugar, for example, in soft drinks. And that there is considerable evidence that it is better to eat complex sugars, starches, or to eat some kind of balance of sugars and other components rather than pure sugar. And there are some physiological sound explanations in terms of excretions of insulin, blood glucose, and so forth and so on. Also, some of the diet composition, and you know, Michael Pollan comes into this very much, actually touch on the growth hormone story, because growth hormone is the main driver of insulin-like growth factor, which is linked with cancer. And insulin-like growth factor is also very much regulated by nutrition, particularly by intake of proteins and amino acids. So the diet heavily weighed toward meat is likely to maintain higher IGF-1 levels than diet with relatively lower percentage of amino acids and proteins and higher percentage of other components. And this came up in very interesting studies of cronies, the people from who voluntarily practice calorie restriction. This is work of Luigi Fontana at WashU in St. Yes. Louis, showing that these people who actually practice rather severe calorie restriction and have low BMI, low body weight, and they have very favorable lipid profiles, low blood pressure, and you know, many characteristics of their physiological functioning, which, you know, would be considered by most criteria to be very beneficial and projecting good health and long life. One of the surprising findings in these people was that the IGF-1 was not low. So, if
now, just remind us all what the IGF-1 means then.
IGF-1 is insulin-like growth factor 1, which is a substance which circulates in blood. And that IGF-1 which circulates in blood is derived mostly from the liver, produced mostly under influence of growth hormone, but also depending on nutrients.
Right.
So it seems that by, you know, having a diet which is not very heavy into proteins, particularly animal protein, you can keep your IGF-1 lower, which presumably protects you from cancer. So there will be a little connection to this, eat mostly plants, as perhaps right. a good advice.
Right. So I was reading the other day, I'd just like to get your thoughts on this in the last couple of minutes here. There was an English philosopher called Bernard Williams, who wrote an essay called The Macropolis Case, mm-hmm. Reflections on the Tedium of Immortality. And it's a philosopher's analysis of a play by Karel Čapek, which was later made into an opera by Janáček. And it tells of a woman called Elena Makropoulos, or various times throughout life, and she lives. She's tried out an elixir of life, and at the time of the action that takes place, she's 342 years old, and her unending life has come to a state of boredom, indifference, and coldness. Everything is joyless. In the end, it is the same. She says, singing in silence, and she refuses to take the elixir again. Have you given much thought to these kind of more philosophical issues, like the benefits of and the problems of this extremely extended lifespan? It's a kind of an Aubrey de Grey issue, isn't it, to some extent? But
well,
suppose you all are immensely successful and Is there any reason why people couldn't be living these extraordinary lifetimes?
Well, I personally find it. I believe that human life can be extended by managing what you eat, among other things, and healthy lifestyle, and pharmaceutical support and better treatment for various diseases and so forth. It's been happening for a long time now, mm-hmm. and I think it will continue. And I think it's wonderful. Now, I am rather skeptical of all proposals that there is some danger, risk, or evil in trying to extend life. I think it's a very positive agenda. And the reason I'm saying this is there are many reasons I'm saying this. One is that, after all, average lifespan within the last few generations increased hugely. Mm-hmm. And apart from the current problems with managing social security budget and so forth, which I think are more problems of politics and management than real issues, apart from these problems, nothing terrible has happened to any society because people live longer. I think in general that has been a positive thing. There is some concern about changing age composition of the population and how this may impose unfair burden on the younger people to support older people. But I think this will find its own solution. I think it's already finding its own solution in the United States, that people tend to retire later. People mm-hmm. tend to work after they retire, which means that at least some of the older people take care of their own financial needs rather than looking to the younger generations to do it for them. And also that people past the customary working years are still contributing to society, hopefully in some positive ways. Many people who are retired and not gainfully employed are working as volunteers. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us came across volunteers in hospitals, in national parks, in state parks, in other places where I think these older people are clearly doing something positive for the rest of the population. So, and for themselves. I really don't think that there is any good example or any evidence that making people live longer causes problems. That this is issue that people keep raising, but I think there's really no data to support that this is an issue. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem of maintaining people who are in very poor health and need to be institutionalized, for example, people with Alzheimer's disease being a very extreme case. This is maybe a more real issue when you talk about extending longevity, but on the other hand, there are very strong data from animal research and I think also clinical data supporting the fact that generally when you extend longevity, you also extend a period of good health. So this period right. when people may be in very bad shape and require costly support and care and labor-intensive management by other people, that this period is probably not going to get any longer if people live longer. It will simply come later. It will come at a different nominal age. But it's very likely that people toward the end of life very often would be more or less helpless and require lots of support. But I think there's really no sound reason to believe that this period is going to be any longer, any worse if people live longer. And on the level that this philosopher brought up, actually there are questions of quality of life and self-satisfaction and so forth. And perhaps surprisingly, particularly surprising to young people, old people appear to be quite pleased with their lives, and even if they have very significant medical and economical issues, they generally rate their quality of life rather highly, and they are not unhappy, they are not depressed as a group. So I really don't think that it is an evil idea to make people live longer.
Okay. On that happy note, Andy Varghese, thanks very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Well, perhaps we'll continue this conversation next year, and the year after, and the year after, and the year after.
God willing.